Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
The book is called Damnation Island, and the author is Stacy Horn, who's written a few books, first time on this show. Stacy, welcome aboard.
Thank you for having me.
So, you know, what I mean by I was grossed out was because I was listening, and I put it on, and I had no idea what it was going to be about. I didn't know what this was. And this is about Roosevelt Island, is what it's called today, but Blackwell's Island. And that was a place for the insane, I guess you would call it, like an insane asylum.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
among other things.
The part that I was, that really freaked me out was because you described all of them taking a bath in the same bath water. And how sludgy and dark and gross it was getting, because there was like 150 women that would, one after the other, get into the same tub of water.
Yeah, the patients would complain about that, you know, over the decades, and their complaints were ignored. And so I wanted the reader to be very clear about how awful that was, and it wasn't just a minor complaint. But we're talking about the 19th century, so there wasn't plumbing. So in order to fill the bath, they had to carry pails of water over. And they just decided at a certain point that that was too much work, and the women were going to just bathe over and over and over and over in the same few bathtubs that were filled each day. And so I tried to describe just how gross that would be, you know, by the 25th woman. Because these are women that were coming over in all sorts of states. So they could be diseased, they could have syphilis, they could have lice, they could have been playing with their feces. So by the time later women got in the water, it would just be thick with sludge and vermin and things moving around, and nobody would want to get into that.
Yeah, what's the point?
Yeah,
what's the point of
what is the point?
Yeah, you'd come out dirtier than you went in.
And you were forced to go in, whether you liked it or not. So a very calming, soothing introduction to life in the asylum.
Yeah, it got my attention. You know, and in a horrifying way, and it was. So why can it, just jumping ahead to why was it ignored, and why if they complained about it, Was it just because we're talking about insane, or they figured unstable people? Like, what was? Don't we have a duty to at least treat them more of a human, give them, you know, a proper bath and towels? And
well,
stuff?
You would think. You would think it would be the more Christian thing to do, to treat them with kindness. But let me just back up a little bit. The city bought Blackwell's Island in 1828, and when they bought it, they originally started with the best of intentions and to treat them more humanely than they'd ever been treated anywhere in the world before. At the time, Bellevue, which is now known as a hospital in New York, also housed the city's lunatic asylum and a couple of prisons and an almshouse. And as a result, it was terribly overcrowded and conditions were also inhumane. And so the city bought Blackwell's Island, which at the time was this beautiful pastoral island full of fruit trees, thinking, you know, they would build state-of-the-art institutions to replace what they had then, and people would go there and be treated with compassion, and they'd be healed if they were sick, or they'd be reformed if they were being sent to prison, and they would come back to the city in better shape than when they were first sent out there. So they really meant well. They even went down to Philadelphia to look in a new asylum that had adopted something called moral treatment, which was, you know, a revolutionary form of treatment at the time that started in Europe. And it basically, I mean, it sounds so like common sense now, but they said instead of putting them in straitjackets and throwing them into prison and doing treatments like bloodletting, let's treat them, let's not restrain them, let's treat them with compassion and kindness and feed them well, house them well, give them useful and satisfying things to do with themselves during the day rather than locking them in dark dungeons. And perhaps they'll get better if we try this instead.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, they just made mistake after mistake after mistake. First, they underestimated how many people they were ultimately going to commit to that island every year. The lunatic asylum, oh God, I'm forgetting what their average daily population was. I think it was around maybe 1,500 on any one day. But ended up being, excuse me?
I said, good Lord, what were they anticipating?
Well, nobody really knew how many people were suffering from mental illness at the time. And unfortunately, you could get committed for things that are considered less serious today, like if you're having anxiety attacks or suffering from depression. But also people could get committed if they were just kind of eccentric. Husbands could commit wives, families could commit troublesome members of their family, and so it was overcrowded. And then the city did things to save money. The other big thing they did was underestimate just how expensive it is to care for people suffering from mental illness. And they did things like to save money. They took convicts from the workhouse, which was a prison for people convicted of relatively minor crimes. And they took these convicts and then had them working as nurses and attendants in the asylum.
Wow.
So you know that it had to be rife with abuse if they were using convicts.
Oh, it was terrible. It was terrible. It just kept getting worse year after year after year, but I have this great quote from Charles Dickens, and it was only 3 years after the asylum opened, and he wrote about how it had that madhouse air, the moping idiot, the gibbering maniac, and I'm quoting him, these are not my words, with his hideous laugh and pointed finger, they were all there in naked ugliness and horror.
Wow.
So things just kept getting worse and worse and worse. They did things like, my favorite way to illustrate this is when the asylum got crowded, they started building other buildings. And two buildings they built, one was called the Retreat and one was called the Lodge. And that's where they housed the most violent patients that they had. And in rooms that were barely humane enough to fit one woman, they would put two or three or four. And then they would lock them up around 6 o'clock at night, and they would not unlock the door until the next morning. And sometimes they would murder each other in these rooms. And I do actually write about a murder in the retreat. But Nellie Bly is fairly famous. She was a 19th century investigative reporter, and she feigned mental illness in order to get committed to the lunatic asylum on Blackwell's Island so she could write about it, and, you know, from the inside and what it was really like. And she published a series of articles that caused a huge sensation. But I read in her articles how her original intention was to get housed in either the retreat or the lodge, because they were famous as being the worst. But once she got there, and she was put in, like, the best, the nicest part of the asylum, and that was so horrible. I mean, if you read her articles, they're just, they're chilling. And so it was so bad in the best part of the asylum that she decided that she would not go into the retreat or the lodge, because it just wasn't worth jeopardizing her life.
Wow. You know, and so yeah. You have to think about that next time you stay at a lodge or a retreat. In the back of your mind. That's it. Well, and so Nellie Bly, she actually had, didn't she really cause the end of the asylum?
No.
No.
Unfortunately,
that,
no.
That didn't do it. Like,
no.
I mean, wow.
No, that was 1888, and they kept going. I mean, they kept going as bad. And in 1895, the state took over the care of the insane from New York City. And they spent more money, and things were better for a while. But it eventually devolved, because it really is an expensive thing to do well. It's very hard to do well. And I don't know if you remember this, but in the 1970s, there was an expose about an institution here in New York called Willowbrook. I don't know if you ever saw it, but
yeah.
Of all people, this was in the 70s, Geraldo Rivera.
Oh, boy. Snuck in. There we go.
I know, but you're going to be surprised. Like, he started out his career so differently.
Yeah, because back then, I remember this, actually. I remember... this actually made him a very legitimate journalist at the time. He was up for awards, and they were really, this is before all of the stuff.
Al Capone's fault.
Yeah, and all that satanic panic and all the stuff he did after. But the original, I remember.
No, it was, he did a very worthwhile thing. This was in the 1970s. And he snuck in with a camera, and I will never forget that. You see him walking, well, you see what the camera sees, as he walks down the hall, and it's a long hall, and along the walls of each side of the hall are people sitting in on the ground, most of them naked, rocking back and forth in their own urine and feces. It's just the worst possible thing that you can imagine in the most devastating horror novel, and it's real. This is really happening, and that led to a wave of asylum closings and the idea that we should house them in smaller group settings. But that was even more expensive, and now I think they're mostly on the street or in prisons. And the only thing that's saving at least some of them is that there are now drugs available that weren't available then.
So, now get back to the mindset then. In the 1880s, so the average person or citizen outside of the asylum or the retreat, what was the general consensus in population about these women and the insane? Do people just? I'm just trying to capture how they felt.
Well, a couple of things. One of the things that caused part of the problem was the city thought, okay, we're going to build an asylum. And they built two penitentiaries, two prisons, one called the penitentiary, one called the workhouse. an almshouse for the poor, and a hospital to serve people who can't afford health care. And so they thought putting all these people on the same island was humane, but unfortunately, it reinforced this very destructive association between these groups of people that persists to this day. I mean, I'm sure it already existed to some extent, but it really made it this idea in people's mind that these three groups of people, the poor, the mad, and the criminal, were all essentially one and the same.
Or
poor people are criminals. Yes, the poor people, the mentally ill are to be feared. Poor people are basically criminals in disguise. And together with the convicted criminals, they were all, to some extent, guilty of something, and they belong together and away from the rest of us. So it lessened the sympathy for things that happened to them. Probably the people in the lunatic asylum got the most sympathy of any of the groups sent there. They were seen more like innocent victims. But unfortunately, even after things like Nellie Bly's exposés, there was a huge, amount of outrage, and the budget for the department running the island was raised a little bit the next year, but not enough to make any fundamental difference. And then everybody forgot. And things like these exposés, kept coming up again and again and again. I wrote about one that took place in 1880. There was like a series of just terrible deaths in the insane asylum. And one example I gave in the book of just something that happened that just is hard to imagine. But they took a pregnant inmate and they put in the lunatic asylum, put her in a straitjacket, and then put her into solitary, and then just left her there. And while she was there, she gave birth in this, while in a straitjacket.
In a straitjacket.
Alone. Yes. Yes.
By herself.
Exactly.
Oh, my God.
And I know, it's just, who are these people? Who does this? So there was a Senate investigation, and I went through 900 pages of testimony, and it just kills me that they talked to doctors and nurses and former doctors, former nurses, all sorts of people, but they didn't talk to one single patient. And at the end of the 900 pages, they didn't make a single recommendation about how to fix it.
That's the Senate for you.
Oh, that's horrifying.
Well, that's the thing, like, I've said this many times, like, even as I was reading this, I'm thinking, we are no better now. I mean,
right.
Not a day goes by that you don't hear about something terrible happening in our own country, and we all acknowledge, oh my God, that's terrible, and then nothing changes, nothing gets done.
Right, and it's always the same. We'll do a Senate investigation or a Congress, and a whole lot of stuff goes on and nothing changes. Wow.
Yeah.
So who gets held responsible for something like this eventually, or did anyone ever really pay for all of these inhuman behavior, treatment?
No, and I didn't want to knock people over the head with some of the connections I made researching this story, but one of the things I kept noting, I was going over annual reports from each of the departments, overseeing each institution and looking at the budgets and how they spent their money, and one of the things that I discovered right away was that they were starving everybody. They were not feeding anyone nearly enough. I mean, just basically enough to keep them alive. And doctors were pointing this out, even the wardens and the superintendents were pointing this out. You have to give us more money. This is not enough to properly feed you. No one's going to get better, with a diet like this. And so for one of the examples of one of the people sent to the penitentiary, I told the story of the Reverend Cowley, who actually was once a missionary to the island, who started a home for children as an alternative to Blackwell's Island, because Blackwell's Island was a death sentence for children. The mortality rates for infants on the island went between 80 to close to 100%. You send a baby there, it dies. Mm-hmm. So he started this home to give to have another alternative so they could not die. And he ended up being sent to the penitentiary for a year because one of the children in his care got so sick that he took them to the hospital, and they accused him of starving this child, even though there was a lot of evidence that that was not true, and none of the other children in his care were in this state. He was suffering from something, but they didn't really know what. It was like the one time I said, and I just come out and say in my book, like, so he goes to jail for this one kid, and none of the commissioners or anyone running this asylum ever went to prison for the decades-long famine that they had on the island.
Wow. Yeah. Who do you tell when the corruption is at the top? Who do you tell?
Well, and even better, like the workhouse and the penitentiary, the wardens themselves also noticed one thing that I noticed in my research was that only poor people went to prison. The wealthy, the affluent, just almost never were sent to the penitentiary or the workhouse, and they would say that in their annual reports. They would say, you know, we can't help but notice the police justices are only sending poor people to us, and we know the affluent commit crime, so what's the deal here? And the Women's Prison Association sat in the courthouses to see what was going on, and they wrote a report saying that, you know, the wealthy were rarely brought in at all, and if they did, their cases were either dismissed or they were given a fine that they could easily pay and sent on their way.
Well, see, we're in the wrong job.
Yeah, we're doing it all wrong.
It's just like we keep taking the wrong choice, making it. So what happened to the people that died? So, like, when all these, patients, I guess I'll call them, were dying, and that, what did they do with the bodies? And didn't the family of these patients say anything or do anything? Or, like, I'm just trying to figure out what there was just no hue and cry or nothing going on.
Whenever, like, an article would appear through some investigative reporter's efforts, there would be an outrage, but then it would quiet. And it's in terms of the bodies, that's another sad story. There's a few heroes in my book, but one of them is the Reverend William Glennie French, and he was an Episcopal missionary to the island for over 20 years. And he wrote annual reports that were very frank, so I used his annual reports a lot. But he talked about the fact that the people would cry to him all the time because they wanted a Christian burial, and they knew that, especially the people in the almshouse, that's where people who were poor and couldn't afford a place to live, they would go to the almshouse. And they knew that they would likely die there. And unfortunately for the people who died on Blackwell's Island, for many of them, what would happen after they died was their bodies would be given to medical science for education and research. And then their remains would be buried on Potter's Field on Hart Island. And they would cry to him, he has this one terrible thing in his annual report where he talks about how they're so afraid that their body will be buried there on Hart Island, and they buried them in trenches. So I forget,
oh,
I think
my
it was
goodness.
Like 100 adults to the adult trench and 1,000 babies and children in the baby's trench. So their big fear was that they would be buried in a trench, but at the bottom, and if their relatives managed to get enough money to have a decent burial for them, it would be too late. Like, they'd be at the bottom and beyond recognition if their friends wanted to remove them.
Mm-hmm. So they were just mass graves.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how did this finally end, or what drove the hospital to be closed?
Well, my book ends in 1895, and that was because it was a fairly hopeful year. The city was starting to acknowledge what went wrong and coming up with ways to fix things. And as I said, the lunatic asylum was taken over by the state. The state took over the care of all the mentally ill in New York. And they did a better job at first. One thing I also forgot to mention, the island was managed by a department that went by a number of names, but ultimately the name, the Department of Public Charities and Correction. So the same men who were responsible for charitable institutions were also responsible for the prisons. And that was not a smart idea. So in 1895, the department was divided into two, the one for public charities and the one for correction, both of which exist today, although the one for charities goes by a different name. But the Department of Correction is still the Department of Correction. And they decided that the penitentiary and the workhouse were just so miserable that the only thing to do would be to tear them down. And they bought Rikers Island with the idea that they would build a new state-of-the-art penitentiary and workhouse to replace what exists on Blackwell's Island. And so they did in the 1930s, but within a few years it was just as bad as the prisons on Blackwell's Island, and that's because the problems, the things that made them the terrible institutions that they were, had really little to do with the buildings and more with the criminal justice system, which is largely unchanged and in many ways worse today.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Well, this is a fun story. Wow.
It's like, It's a fascinating but terrible, terrible story that just, wherever I looked, it was bad. I mean, like, for instance, I found that in originally the groups that were targeted for incarceration were surprisingly women and the Irish. But then I saw how over time that got transferred to African Americans, and by the time Rikers Island was built, the African American population in prison was on the rise, and the Irish was on the wane.
I guess we were getting used to the Irish by then. You know. So, what was the most, I guess, horrifying or most upsetting thing that you learned about the whole prison during your research?
Well, every bit of it was upsetting, but I think what was most upsetting was when I learned how little things had changed. As I said, I ended my book in 1895, and so I wanted to have an epilogue, so I researched Rikers to see what that was like. And I read this Justice Department report on how teenagers are treated on Rikers Island. And so first, that was upsetting, teenagers on Rikers Island, because I had read in the 19th century how they sent children to the penitentiary. I mean, I found records of 8-year-olds in the penitentiary. And they raised the age to 14. And to hear that, you know, 100 years later, it's only been raised to 16, and we were still essentially sending children to prison. So that was upsetting. But then I read these terrible stories of how they were being brutalized, and I included one brief one in the epilogue where this teacher describes how they pulled a kid from her classroom and then just started beating him in the hallway, and it went on for a long time. Like, a guard would walk by and say, "Oh, have you pepper sprayed him yet?" And they go, "Oh no, go ahead, be my guest." And he'd like have the pepper spray thing, right in front of his face, because he mouthed off to one of them when he said to sit up straight or something like that. I mean, something ridiculously minor. By the way, I say that, but life in Rikers Island, I'm not excusing this kind of brutality, but it's horrible for everyone. The guards, it's. I think it does something to them as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's like a terrible place all around.
Yeah, I would imagine that would affect everybody involved, because it becomes a way of life. I mean, if you're there 5 days a week as a guard, that's a big part of your life.
And I can testify to that, Stacey, because I work in the corrections field, and I have for about 21, 22 years.
Yeah.
But I know the horror that we have come from. Sadly, and I'm willing to admit this on the air right now, I kind of see a swing going in the other direction back to those type of conditions, because they are closing down all the mental health facilities around us. And so where do they put the mentally ill people but in jail?
Yeah.
And we simply don't have the tools to deal appropriately with them. So what do you attribute this to with your research?
Well, that's why I try not to demonize the guards. Like, again, I'm not condoning this kind of brutality, but I read another thing, and this is recently, where, I read an article in the Times about a locked ward in an asylum, though it wasn't called an asylum. I think this was also in the 70s, but it was a locked ward for violent patients only. And then they would, like, throw in guards and nurses, you know, in that same locked facility, and then just leave them. And they were on their own with worse possible patients, who were not in control. So, you know, nobody's the bad guy here, but they were on their own, and they had to defend themselves against these violent people. And it was just a no-win situation for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So that's what I think of when I read about the prison. I'm thinking, again, I have to keep saying this, not condoning that kind of brutality, but they were also in a no-win situation.
Yeah, it's a tough place to be when you're researching and writing a book like this, because you don't want to put blame or demonize a group of people like guards, but at the same point, you have to say what happened. You have to explain the truth.
Exactly. And there is a line.
Yeah.
And what you described with the young man that they were struggling with, speaking as a lieutenant, as a supervisor, that's inexcusable. If you don't have to use that type of force, then why do that other than just for sheer sadistic pleasure?
Yeah, aggression.
Yeah, that's a whole other thing. Yeah.
Yeah. How did this, when you're doing this and going through the book, I'm sure the process took a year or two or who knows. How did it affect you? Like, what changes does it make in you yourself?
Well, now I'm an advocate for criminal justice reform, public health reform, mental health reform. I don't know how effective an advocate I'm going to be, but I recognize that things need to change. I'm afraid that, though...
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, do you think that the public is more receptive to it now? Do you think that if a report came out now about a prison, whether it be insane or asylum or a mental health place, do you think if something like these stories came out now, or Nellie Bly and stuff like that, if that was to come out now, do you think that the general public and do you think our Senate would actually change things?
No, I think that the kind of paralysis that affected them in the 19th century is only worse now. And the only thing I can think of is the kind of leaders that are just so rare that would galvanize some sort of movement, some sort of progression. I mean, we've had them in the past here and there, but it's a rare human being that can move a nation to act.
Yeah.
Mm. To put out the kind of money that's needed to address some of these problems. I mean, I don't see... Yeah. Like Trump talks about bringing back asylums, and it's not that the idea of asylums in and of themselves are a bad idea, but they are extremely expensive. I mean, ridiculously expensive to do well and to not repeat what we did in the 19th century. And when we talk about asylums, we're talking about lower-income families. The wealthy don't get sent to asylums. They can afford the best care that money can buy. So when we're talking about sending people to asylums, we're talking about poor people. And I certainly don't see, in this political climate, that kind of money being spent on mental health care for the poor.
Right. Yeah. Well, and... Do we have any good examples of asylums? And I mean that, like,
good question.
Yeah, because this is a bad one. So, do you have any ones that worked, or do we know of any that were successful in their treatment of mentally?
I am very, very quick trying to look because I read this wonderful article by someone who promotes. Oh, here it is. Improving long-term psychiatric care, bring back the asylum. Now, he is, again, talking about, not what we had on Blackwell's Island. Right. He gave two examples, ones that were good but were very expensive. Here we go. He says, a joint commission-accredited state psychiatric... Oh, he doesn't give the names. He talks about one in Michigan... Oh, here's one in D.C., St. Elizabeth's Hospital. But he says the cost is $328,000 per patient annually.
Oof. Oh, my goodness.
Well, that's the thing. It's very, very expensive.
And that's the sad thing. All the good facilities are so outrageously priced that only the wealthy can afford them.
Yeah. That's why bring back asylums, I think if we did that, we're going to get what we had in the 19th century, and the people that work there are only going to be the people that can, afford to willing to take the pay that we can afford to give them.
Yeah,
and let me make
the best of this.
Let me make this comment and get your take on it. Let's tie this back into corrections. You've got these people in the government that are making all these big decisions, having to do with corrections and mental health, yet they've never served a day as a law enforcement officer, so they don't exactly know what they're legislating.
Yeah. Well, in New York, they're actually talking, de Blasio has committed to closing Rikers in 10 years. The complaint about that is he won't be around in 10 years, so he's essentially kicking the can down the road, and I tend to agree. Yeah. But at least a movement has begun to close Rikers. So that's something. But I recently wrote an op-ed about this saying, you know, essentially what I said to you, you know, closing Rikers, you know, that's not really the issue. You know, it's not, the problem is not in the buildings. It's in our criminal justice system. So I talk about, you know, reducing or eliminating bail. And also for me, which is now my new thing, is I think, you know, we have basically standing armies in every city, town, state in America going after the crimes of lower-income Americans. But we don't have standing armies in every city, state, and town going after white-collar criminals. And I think if we had, and their crimes, I would argue, are equally destructive, if not more so, mm-hmm. and more far-reaching than, you know, one guy, you know, selling marijuana, for instance. And if we, for instance, if Rikers was filled with as many, you know, corporate executives and people guilty of bank fraud, it would never become what it is today.
Right. Right.
We have to go after, yeah, we have to go after everyone equally.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's been a problem.
All criminals equally.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's true. I think that, because we're seeing that now in a lot of the news reports we get, you know, people getting, I don't know, it's over-policing, you know, over silly, just minor crimes. And
yeah.
And they're getting beat up for it, you know.
Yeah.
It just.
And we're not, you know, investigating or arresting or prosecuting white collar criminals like anywhere near the extent. I mean, it's just, it's so uneven. It's ridiculous.
Do you think that's just because maybe in general the police don't think, or even the public don't think of the white collar crimes as bad, because they don't have, they don't see it. It's not something that affects them in their day to day life. Whereas breaking and
entering
pot and all that, you sort of
exactly
you're exposed.
It's not right. You're right. It's not written about. It's not sensationalized. It's just there's been no focus on it the way there has been for, you know, close to 200 years here. If we had television shows and police forces, you know, constantly investigating and reporting on these crimes, people would be more aware of them and how it's affecting them, because it is.
Right. And so many of the, you know, fraud and white-collar crimes don't end up in jail time if they do get caught.
It just kills me. It just kills me. I don't know which publisher would be interested, but I would love to just spend some time researching, like, how many deaths, for instance, I could attribute to white-collar crime, you know, to crises in the economy that led to people losing, you know, their homes, their health insurance, or how many corporations withheld information about the dangers of their products, which ultimately led to deaths. And I could just show, you know, these crimes are destructive and lethal.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just not done in the same way, but it's still happening.
No. Yeah.
Is that sort of the main point of the book as well? I mean, is that sort of what you want people to get out of the book, or was there something else?
Well, it didn't start to be. I mean, I've always been interested in morbid stories, and definitely interested in the stories of people that something terrible happened to them and it was forgotten and no one ever answered for it. It's why I was drawn to the writing a book about the NYPD's cold case squad. You know, the idea that, all these people were murdered and the murderers got to go on and live their lives and nobody ever was held accountable. And so I knew that something terrible had happened on Blackwell's Island. So, you know, I was drawn to the idea of resurrecting these stories of these people. who were treated badly, who something wrong happened. But I wasn't doing it to preach to anyone, and I certainly didn't think that I was going to go in there seeing all these parallels to what's going on now. So when I wrote the book, I just, except for a sentence here and a sentence there where I just, it would be irresponsible not to point out that something is still happening today. But again, it's only a couple sentences in the whole book. But I decided that I would just tell the story of what happened and, for the most part, let the reader draw their own conclusions.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of the best
way. Well, I, for one, appreciate it.
Yeah. That's really the best way to go. Not to tell people how to think, but give them the information, and hopefully they're able to, you know, put it together. And
nobody likes to be lectured to.
No, and it's an easy way to get cast into a category now too. You know.
Yeah.
You know, be
safe. And I try to limit portraying anyone as the bad guy, because as I said earlier, you know, I understand the paralysis that happens when things go bad and you just feel overwhelmed and you feel like nothing you're doing is going to help. So, since that's me today, I wasn't going to point my finger to anyone that was like that then.
Yeah.
And I just, kind of, you know, there every once in a while there was somebody that was a bad guy and I point that out. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, they're just a bunch of people in over their heads.
Did it ever make you wonder, but, you know, some of the people that were working in the asylum itself, how they could just do some of the things they do without it affecting them? Like, even if they didn't speak out, just like, you know, say the people, you know, putting all the ladies in the same bath over and over and see them get in the dirt and, as you said, feces and all this stuff going on. And but as an attendant, how could it not affect you when you got home or later to think of what you're doing?
Right. That's what makes me think of the guards at Rikers. I mean, this is your job. So how can it not damage you, too, in some way, to do it? And so, yeah, I read about some nurses who were just plain tyrannical and evil, just like, you know, some of those guards on Rikers who just went over, they crossed the line, it's a different thing. But for most of them, I thought they were just above the poverty level themselves for the most part, and this was the only job they could get. And it was terrible for them too.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure. I just try to put myself in their mind, the mindset of going through the motions of, you know, leading the inmates or what you would call them, the patients into these awful situations. Like it's
Like,
well, it does affect you.
Yeah,
it does. I mean, you actually get you have to get callous. If you're going to stay in the industry, you've got to become callous. And perhaps that's where I struggle, because I am, you know, I believe that I'm a compassionate person, and I care for them as human beings. But sometimes we're faced with situations where you've got no other choice but to, you know, react in a certain manner.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, of course.
I know. Yeah.
You know, of course. I mean, that's you know, you're drawn into that situation. I'm just thinking in the asylum when you're, I don't know what you call them, caretaker, or if you're a nurse or what you are, and you know, just putting people through, you know, like making them get into the really nasty bathtub, making them do things that's just, you wouldn't do yourself. It's just kind of outrageous. Mm-hmm. And these people are supposed to be sick.
No, yeah.
Yeah.
Criminals. That's sort of, so you know, it's a different situation, I think. Slightly different. I mean, you know, they're in a place for a reason, but
Let's look at it this way. And like Stacy kind of alluded to, you have certain people that will take on a job like this because they, you know, they have the sickness themselves, and they enjoy you know, submitting people to, you know, inhumanities like that. And then you've got the other type that come into this industry with all the best intentions in the world. I want to help these people and I'm going to heal people. And you're faced with that horrible, harsh reality that this is what it is. So, you know, to my way of seeing it, you've got two people or two types of people that get into this industry.
Yeah. Well, a lot of the people that were the ones doing the physical labor, like holding those women in the baths, those were the workhouse convicts. They were not nurses. Mm.
Oh, so they weren't like trained professionals.
No. Trained professionals came much, much later. They started a nurses academy. Oh, God, I'm forgetting the year, but in the 1870s. And those nurses initially went to the hospitals on the island, not the lunatic asylum.
Wow. So you didn't even have really professionals running these facilities or, you know, doing the main part of the work.
Well, that kind of career was relatively new at the time. They called them alienists back then, people who had a specialty. What? Did you watch the show?
No.
I read part of the book, so...
Wow. Yeah, well, that's the world that they were living in the time. There was not a lot known, and nurses, you know, trained nurses were unheard of until towards the end of the 19th century.
And so you think the trained nurses now don't make much of a difference?
I know less about current mental health facilities than I do the 19th century.
Yeah.
But I'm sure they must.
Yeah, I would hope.
At least to some extent, yeah.
Well, I would hope. I would hope that they have a better working knowledge and an overall compassion as being a nurse. But
yeah, well, the people I can't imagine who was applying for these jobs, because I remember reading a complaint from one of the superintendents who ran the asylum saying that we were paying our nurses. I mean, they called them nurses, but they still weren't trained nurses. He said they were paying them less than what women would make hired as servants in a wealthy person's home. So they're going to take that job over this job if they can get it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
A private nurse makes more.
The pay is good.
Not a nurse, just a servant in a home, yeah. Like a cook or a house cleaner.
Yeah.
They were making more than the nurses on Black Wolf Island.
So it was a great paying job. Wow.
And you didn't even have state retirement.
No. That's, you know, wow. Well, this has been very interesting. It's been a very uplifting show. And
sorry.
No, it's good. We've had writer and cat butler, Stacey Holmes. So you're a cat butler. How's that?
I have three cats, and they rule the roost around here. It's like me taking care of them. I feed them whatever they need. I do. I'm their servant.
Yeah. It's funny how the animal becomes kind of in charge without the responsibility.
Yeah, but it comes with good medical insurance.
Yeah. You get everything you want. Well, it's been very interesting. I think fantastic. We'll have the book. We already do, actually. It's already linked up on our website, Damnation Island. And, of course, you can go to Stacey Horn's website. And I believe it's just stacyhorn.com, isn't it?
That's it.
So we have all that linked up. And the book is definitely worth reading or listening to if you have bad eyes like me. Thank you very much for taking the time and talking to us today.
Well, I had a very great time in spite of the subject. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Stacey.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
Have been completed.
The end! By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me,
it back.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
When your skin feels nourished and glows, you radiate confidence. Osea makes giving your skin a glow-up easy with their clean, clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This seaweed-powered duo features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code GLOW.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.